Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities with Lori Peterson and Abby Weinstein. Lori and Abby spend their days talking about dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. They talk to parents of struggling students and adults who have had a lifetime of academic challenges. They want to share those stories along with their own insights with you. So, let's talk learning disabilities.
Hey everybody, this is Lori.
And this is Abby.
Welcome to the next episode of Let's Talk Learning Disabilities. Hope everyone's doing okay today and in the back to school swing.
Yeah.
We're about a month in now, so I feel like everybody's kind of found their rhythm, kind of, maybe.
Hopefully.
Sort of. So today we have a really interesting topic. It's one we get asked about a lot. Mm-hmm. People are always wanting to know about alternative treatments for ADHD. And we don't really have a lot of tricks up our sleeve. So we are excited today to learn about something new. Abby, who's with us today?
Today we have a special guest. Of course, they're all special. We have the director of neurofeedback with Heritage Counseling and Consulting, and we have Miss Betsy Ezell. Hi, Betsy. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
We appreciate you. This is going to be such great information. And like I said, we are very limited on our knowledge of things that people can do outside of just medication. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people aren't comfortable with that, which I totally get. So mm-hmm. we want to look at what other alternatives might be out there. So first, if you don't mind, before we kind of dive deep into neurofeedback, can you tell us a little bit about you and how you landed where you are?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a licensed clinician. So I did my training in therapy. I loved therapy, but all my life I thought I was going to be a doctor. And so I have a big love for medicine and science. And when I was training to be a therapist, I learned about neurofeedback, and it felt like the perfect mix for me of a harder science where we look at brainwave activity, and more of like the relational holistic treatment orientation to therapy. And so I pursued both when I was in school. So I did all of the training and hours requirements to become a therapist, in addition to all of the trainings and requirements to become board certified in neurofeedback. So I've rolled out neurofeedback programming in a couple of offices. I've run a couple of offices, and then now oversee our neurofeedback programming in all of the Heritage offices and our neurofeedback staff.
That's awesome. All right.
Okay, so then
let's get to it.
What exactly is neurofeedback?
Yeah, so neurofeedback is a type of brain training. So neurofeedback falls under the umbrella, or a larger umbrella, called biofeedback, which is any sort of tool or mechanism that can give you information about your physiological responses to something in real time. So neurofeedback is a specialized type of biofeedback where we can monitor and record brainwave activity and use that information to get an understanding about functionally how a brain's using its resources, how brainwaves are distributed across the cortex. And we can use that information to target actual neurofeedback training. Neurofeedback training is, in effect, operant conditioning, where we target brainwave patterns in certain areas of the brain, and we work to regulate their functioning. So we place sensors on the scalp, target specific brainwaves, and we train them into more normative patterns.
How do you train them? That's so fascinating.
It is fascinating.
It's a good question. So we use information that we get from what's called a QEEG, or a quantitative electroencephalogram, where we look at brainwave functioning and parts of the brain that may be functioning atypically or suboptimally. We're really looking at central nervous system activation when we look at functional brain imaging. And so we're taking a look at what parts of the brain are contributing to maybe not optimal symptoms. So inattention or difficulty with emotional regulation or mood management, anxiety management. And we can see those neural networks and how they're working. And so if we see a part of the brain that's maybe overutilizing or underutilizing a specific brainwaves activity, we can put a sensor on the scalp, and our software designate that we want that particular brainwave to be allocated less resources or less power. And so clients earn a positive reward as that particular frequency decreases in power. So Oftentimes, a positive reward comes in one of two ways. Sometimes folks will watch a TV show when they're in a reward state or when their brain is meeting the criteria that we've set. Their TV show is full screen and full color. And then when they're not achieving the thresholds that we've set, the TV show will zoom out and gray out.
And so do they figure out what it takes as far as what they're doing physically to alter those brain waves?
That's a great question. So actually, no, it's a subconscious type of training. You can't force it. You can't make it happen. You can't really figure it out. We ask clients to be alert and engaged. Like, we want them to want the positive feedback, but actually the more you try to force it, the worse you do.
Interesting. Mm. Okay. That is so cool.
That is very interesting. So then being aware of the physiological symptoms that you're feeling, let's say you're having a lot of anxiety and your heart is racing, your palms are sweating, your chest is tight. Would I also see certain brain waves showing up on the computer screen? Or are
that
you
correlate.
That correlate, or are those physiological symptoms? Are you not teaching me how to be more aware of my physiological symptoms and how to respond to them?
That's a beautiful question. It's a well-articulated question. So if we were doing that, if we were giving the body immediate information about their physiological symptoms, meaning racing heart, a lot of times our temperature will increase. So sometimes we'll monitor temperature on hands or feet. Or if we look at breath rate, or heart rate variability, all of that is actually biofeedback, where we're giving a person immediate information about a physiological symptom. Neurofeedback's a little bit more nuanced than that because clients don't know what brainwave is meeting the criteria that we've set for it. They have no idea. We know because we're monitoring it on our software. But what they know is that they are getting they're getting more positive reward and they like that.
Right.
But they don't know exactly what's causing it.
Okay.
So you're really training the brain and not the person.
Correct.
That is too cool. So,
right.
So how long is a typical session?
Great question. It depends by clinic. Oftentimes, sessions are going to run somewhere between 30 to 50 minutes. It depends on the type of training and the how much dialogue is built into the sessions. But a typical session between 30 and 50 minutes. And because it's operant conditioning, it's all learning based. There's nothing that's forcing the brain to remember what we're teaching it at all. It requires more consistent sessions. So typically folks are going to be doing our feedback between 2 and 3 times a week for somewhere between, you know, our literature says best results typically are between 20 and 40 sessions. There's some deviation there dependent on the individual, but folks are typically going to be with us in our clinic specifically somewhere between 10 and 20 weeks with a few outliers.
And I was going to ask, does it also depend on what types of symptoms or what condition you're trying to treat?
Another fantastic question. So yes, anecdotally, there are some behavior presentations, symptom presentations that we know historically are going to take a little bit longer. What's tricky about it when we just approach it with the thought of brain dysregulation or brain wave dysregulation, sometimes certain brains, they just take longer. So their symptoms might be more mild, but they may be more resistant to change because dysfunction is dysfunction. So if I have mild anxiety or if I have severe anxiety, the presentation of my brain is still dysfunction, and encouraging that EEG pattern or that brainwave pattern to shift is really dependent on the person.
Okay.
How quickly in that 10 to 20 weeks or whatever, you know, sessions or whatever, do people start to notice a difference in their day-to-day life?
Yeah, so we tell folks to expect that somewhere between 5 and 10 sessions is when you should be noticing measurable change. Right. So we say once you're 5 weeks in, you should really be noticing something, but we really need the 5 weeks. Right. There are clients that come in and they do their first session and they notice immediately. They're very sensitive to it. And there are clients where it can take 8 or 9 or 10 sessions.
Huh.
Is some of that placebo effect, though, when it works right away? Or can it really be that sensitive?
It really can be that sensitive. Certainly, there's placebo at play. Certainly. But it really can happen that fast. Really dysregulated brains, really, really, really dysregulated brains typically respond pretty fast because there's already a lot going on. So they'll listen to the feedback really quickly, but it'll take much longer for it to become a repeatable pattern. Alternatively, really, really, really regulated brains that just have some suboptimal functioning patterns can take a very long time to shift, and then they move into maintenance really quickly.
That makes sense.
Okay.
So what's the benefit or the negative or whatever of biofeedback versus neurofeedback? Neurofeedback is a type of biofeedback, but that biofeedback, you said you get the immediate response. Mm-hmm. So what... Is there a benefit to doing one versus the other? Is one better for one thing and then not the other?
Yeah. How do you choose?
Yeah, great questions. My answer is a little bit nuanced. One of the things about biofeedback that's really important is that you have to have buy-in. You have to recruit buy-in from your client to want to notice the difference and then to be willing to apply a skill or some sort of intervention to help regulate that physiological symptom. With neurofeedback, we don't need that. We need you, say, if you're a 7-year-old with really significant ADHD and really significant hyperactivity behaviors, we really just need you to want to watch this movie, which requires a lot less from them.
Just to show up and watch the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really an advantage because you don't have to have the buy-in, you don't really have to have the engagement, and you don't have to have them practicing a skill or implementing a strategy.
Right.
So that is pretty cool. So
that's awesome.
We mentioned ADHD. What other, and anxiety, what other conditions or symptoms can neurofeedback treat?
So from an evidence-based perspective, neurofeedback's efficacy is the highest with focus and attention in ADHD. It's where we got our start in the United States. That's been the bread and butter of the field for a long time. Bodies of research that kind of are subsequent to that, they're still good, but not quite as large, are going to be in the treatment of PTSD, head injury recovery, sleep issues, mood and anxiety disorders. And then actually remarkably, pretty rapidly in the field, we're noticing a pretty significant uptick in white papers that are demonstrating the efficacy for nerve feedback with autism spectrum disorders.
Really?
Mm-hmm. That's great. Awesome. So, and then the providers that are providing the neurofeedback, they are specifically trained. You can't just go into any, clinic and say, turn on the computer and let's do neurofeedback, places popping up on the corner that say they're going to help your kids' attention and focus and balance out their brain or help their brain connect. Mm-hmm. Is that correct that has very specific training and expertise involved with administering and doing it with efficacy and fidelity?
Yeah, it is my strong bias that it is absolutely necessary to work with someone that knows how to read EEG, that is constantly looking at the EEG, and that has been trained how to treat the EEG. Unfortunately, there are opportunities where you can walk in the door and you can say, I have symptoms of ADHD, and people will say, we have a button for ADHD. You can sit down, we'll press our ADHD button, and that's kind of what you get. But the problem with that is that for a subset of the population, that is adequate. But for a larger percentage of the population, don't have the most common presentation for ADHD symptoms. So there's four most common EEG presentations that we see that indicate focus and attention issues, and we train them all differently. When we talk about mood and anxiety disorders, it's far more significant. Depression has almost 12.
Wow.
Right? And so if you only have one protocol or one plan, you're not going to effectively treat the population. And it's my opinion and my bias that you can absolutely do harm. I also have a strong bias about doing adequate preparation on the front end. It's important to have a significant history taking period. It's important to get a full 19-channel EEG to ensure safety. Right? There's a percentage of folks that have mental and behavioral health issues that it's metabolic or physiological, or even there's epileptiform activity at play. And we have to rule those things out to safely train a brain. Mm-hmm. Not even properly train a brain, but just safely and safely, then properly. Yeah.
If someone's taking medication to treat their symptoms, is that going to impact their ability to make progress through a program like this?
Yes and no. The drug class really matters. So there are specific drug classes of medications that's really difficult to get strong benefit if those particular drugs are in the system. And that would be illicit substance or prescribed drug. And then there are others where the effects are more global. The half-life of the drug is long, and it's less problematic. So it really depends.
Okay. That's so fascinating.
That is fascinating. Does health insurance cover neurofeedback?
And that is the million-dollar question. It depends. It depends. So state by state, it really varies. There are states that are extremely neurofeedback positive, and they will actually pay money to providers to learn how to do it. There are other states where the commercial payers will not pay. It really varies. It really depends.
Okay. Is it still considered an alternative treatment?
It's another great question. It depends on the payer. It depends on the state. But almost always yes, because typically, at least where neurofeedback has really grown in popularity, is that it can be a medication alternative. And so they kind of pool it as an alternative treatment. But in certain areas of the country, it's really changing. And in other areas, it's really not.
Okay. Makes sense.
That does make sense. And is there an age limit as far as young and old that where you see the best, you know, effects?
Yeah. So in our clinic, we really feel that 6 years old is a good place to start. We can go down to 5 if the candidate is precisely right for us, but we do need to be working with someone whom can be engaged for 30 minutes watching a TV show. So we just want to be mindful of that. There's also some growth factors that are important when we're looking at brainwave activity. We need to see someone that's old enough that we can see healthy brainwave rhythms developing. And there really actually is no cap on the latter part of the lifespan. We work with clients a lot who are looking for, you know, cognitive performance improvement, or they want to sleep better, or they want a little bit more brightness during their good hours. And we do that often. So well into their 90s, we've trained clients.
Okay. It can help with sleep?
It can help with sleep. It's actually really highly evidenced for sleep improvement. So falling asleep and sleep maintenance are very common reasons for folks to seek our services.
Wow. That's fascinating. I might have to come see you.
Yeah. It's really interesting because the way that our brain works is just telling us how our central nervous system is working. And when we have atypical rhythms in our nervous system, we typically have an inflexible system. And so neurofeedback at its core, we're just working to increase flexibility so that we can stay in the state we want to be longer. We can sleep better. We can pay attention longer. We feel happier longer. We can manage a negative feeling for longer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is there a myth that people come to you with? Like, is there one thing that when people call and ask about neurofeedback that's like a very common myth that you hear that you'd like to dispel right here and now?
There's many. One is for many of my teenagers, I can't read your brain. I can't read your thoughts. I'm not going to tell your secrets. And then for more kind of on a larger scale in the field, that we, when neurofeedback is offered ethically and, by well-trained and well-educated providers, the risk is very, very low.
Okay.
That's good to know. I'm sure that would be a fear for people. Yeah. You're hooking up brain, you know, electrodes to their head. That could be a little freaky.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of risk, I mean, are there any side effects?
There can be. When neurofeedback is offered appropriately, the risk for a negative side effect is quite low. But if a provider, for instance, is maybe just a little bit, even a fourth of a hertz off of the target frequency for training, sometimes folks will tell us they felt tired after session, or maybe they had a mild headache, or and if we're, you know, training maybe a little bit too high, folks might tell us they had a hard time falling asleep. But it's very rare. It only happens in about 10% of our clients, and we almost never see that side effect last for more than about 10 hours. There's nothing forcing the brain to continue the pattern, and so there's no reason for the brain to keep repeating it. It's important, though, that whomever your provider is tracking that. It's really easy to mitigate those responses, but somebody needs to know to look for it and then know how to shift it.
So be sure to report that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And pretty much everybody's going to really seek your report.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That is so fascinating.
I am like, my eyes are open. Like, this is so cool.
And
I think
that this
is such a great alternative. Or even to do, it's not even just in place of medication. I mean, it sounds like it would be something good. Why not try all the options you can to get, you know, to be at your optimal and, mm-hmm. and perform at your optimal, get your brain working at its very best. So
yeah,
I love that.
Well, I mean, and we do, I meet with a lot of parents who are opposed to medication, or even, you know, I've met with a lot of adult clients who have had negative experiences with medication for whatever reasons. They're like, I just can't take ADHD medications. So they're left with, you know, working with an ADHD coach and, you know, and you know, some behavior modification strategies. But also you still have to implement those strategies. So it's great to know that there are other options out there.
Where can people get more information on neurofeedback if they're interested?
So anybody would be welcome to look at the information that we have on our website. Our practice is called Heritage Counseling. We have a whole area of our website dedicated to literature and information about neurofeedback. We detail how we move through things. And then I would always recommend looking at information that's put out by the ISNR, or the International Society for Neuromodulation Research. Okay. They're going to have up to date what's been published and what's happening in the
awesome.
Field.
Well, thank you. Thank you
That's
so much
great.
For being with us today. This has been amazing.
Very informative.
Although you're not necessarily in our city, we definitely would probably, I think both of us are thinking, gosh, this might be kind of cool to try.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, you do have offices in our city.
Yeah.
We do. So
you're not.
I'm personally not there, but I actually read and review all of our QEG brain maps. It's always me that reviews them, and I write our treatment protocols as well. So we'd be happy to work with you.
Oh, that's awesome.
Okay.
That's good to know. I know we're in good hands then.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And we'll put links to your website in our show notes for those people that want to learn more about neurofeedback and what Heritage Counseling and Consulting does.
A lot. They do a lot.
They do a lot.
So yeah, definitely worth checking out.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Betsy. This has been very informative, and I hope all our listeners have really benefited from this.
If you guys have any questions for us or for Betsy, you can always reach out to letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com. If you're interested in our podcast,
you can visit our podcast website at ltldpodcast.com, where you can view every episode chronologically, or you can choose them grouped by categories and listen that way. Just look for a box that has the category you want, click on it, and every episode that has mentioned that specific category will come up.
So thank you, guys. Thank you, Betsy.
Yeah.
Hope everyone has a great day.
Take care, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In our show notes, you can find information about today's talk, as well as links to resources and other episodes. If you have questions about today's talk, have ideas for future episodes, or just want to stay connected, you can contact us through Diagnostic Learning Services on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So, let's keep talking learning disabilities. This podcast is sponsored by eDiagnostic Learning. You can find more information at www.ediagnosticlearning.com.